Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments at 12 noon, play will be suspended, and we will observe a 2-minute silence in memory of the victims of last week's London bombings. This will begin on the sound of an air horn.
Sounds from the British Open at St. Andrews in Scotland, as all of Great Britain observed the London bombings, which took place exactly 1 week ago today. In the continuing investigation, police in London are asking survivors of the bus bombing to contact them. They're looking to track the movements of the alleged bomber, Hasib Hussein, to see if he had any contact with any other person on the way to the bus, or to find out what route he might have taken. Well, joining us from London is Mark Rice-Oxley, a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Mark, what more do we know about the identity of the alleged bombers?
Well, as you mentioned, Hasib Hussein was the bus bomber. A second young Briton of Pakistani descent, Pakistani origin, second generation, but born in Britain, Shehzad Tanweer has been named as one of the three subway bombers. The other two haven't been named, but it's becoming apparent that the third was another young Briton of Pakistani origin, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan. The fourth subway bomber is believed to be a Briton of Jamaican origin and a Muslim convert.
We know that in at least one case of the bombers, he comes from a fairly well-off middle-class home.
Absolutely. I think this is what surprised a lot of Britons here, is the comparatively normal middle-class background of some of these people. You know, from a part of Leeds in the north that's not, you wouldn't call it affluent, but you wouldn't say it's destitute either. One of them a cricket fan, you know, the game of the middle classes. Another one a primary school assistant teacher. These people would not stand out.
What about a search for collaborators or perhaps a mastermind behind the bombings, perhaps even seen on the videotape? How is that progressing?
We understand that there is a very advanced and aggressive hunt for a possible fifth person involved, perhaps a mastermind, perhaps someone who helped these young men with training, with finance, with some kind of support. Spotted, according to police sources, at one of the stations at which the men arrived, the station at which the men arrived in London. That's according to police sources looking at the thousands of tapes of CCTV footage that have been culled to help with this investigation.
Yeah, well, you write in today's Monitor about the fact that because it appears that the attacks were carried out by an enemy within, members of Britain's Muslim community, there are fears of anti-Muslim violence. We know there have already been some incidents. Tell us more.
Well, dozens of reported incidents of attacks on Muslim places of worship. Awful lot of anecdotal evidence of Muslims, you know, being uneasy stepping out in their traditional clothing. And this is what the government's very, very keen to avoid. They want to ensure that the terrorists do not succeed in dividing the British public, and they want to make sure Britain has upwards of 1.6 million Muslims in its 60 million population. This is an important constituency. It's an important part of society, and the government very determined to try and get mainstream Muslim opinion on side.
Well, in fact, you write that there have been about 100 race attacks reported on Muslim targets in less than a week, and in fact, this puts more pressure on the local police force and domestic intelligence. We're going to have more on that in a moment. But the attack has also caused other European countries to rethink their approach to counterterrorism. In the minute we have, what kinds of steps are being taken in, say, France or Germany?
Well, there was a meeting in Brussels yesterday. Europe wants to try and act as a whole. There's a feeling that you know, terrorists are no respecters of borders, and so the borders have to come down to a certain extent when you're talking about police work, when you're talking about intelligence work. Ministers want to see more information sharing. They want to see more data being stored on, you know, telecommunications, internet, email, telephone calls, because they know that terrorists are sophisticated. It's a digital era, and they use these means of communication to organize their episode, their spectaculars. So Europe wants to act in a more coordinated, joined-up sort of way. That's proven difficult in the past. It remains to be seen if they can, you know, transcend some of these national instincts and get a more of a pan-European approach together.
Mark Rice-Oxley is a London-based correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Mark, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Well, the latest issue of the British Policeman's Trade Journal, Jane's Police Review, is being mailed to police stations around Britain today. Katrina Marchant is editor of Jane's Police Review. She joins us now from London. Katrina, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you.
And I'm assuming it's safe to say that the bombings dominated your coverage this week.
They certainly did. I mean, we did a 10-page special report on the London bombings, and in particular the police reaction, the police response to the bombings, personal accounts of police officers who were first on the scene. So there were three different police forces involved in the immediate response. There was the British Transport Police, who, if you like, the subway police, mm-hmm. who went underground. There's the Metropolitan Police Service, and also the police service that polices the City of London.
And to remind us, are these policemen armed? Do they have guns?
No, they're all unarmed police officers. No frontline bobbies, if you like, on the beat carry firearms in this country. There are specialist units of police officers who carry firearms, but they're part of the sort of firearms response team.
Right. And as you mentioned, the City of London Police are sort of a business district police force.
Yes, I mean, they specialise in policing what's called the square mile, so it's all the big city institutions in the City of London, the big banks. So they were involved in the Aldgate tube bombing, which is on their patch.
They tell, from what I can read, what you've sent us, they tell of horrific discoveries as they raced underground. People coming out of the tube with their hands, arms, and legs missing. A really solid first-person account of the aftermath of the bomb. Another officer that you speak with immediately started treating it as a crime scene. He took out pen and paper and asked people streaming out of the tube to give their names, and they did.
I think obviously that was an experienced police officer who happened to be outside King's Cross just minutes after the explosion. So I think then they just get into sort of the emergency response, and of course, you know, they do need to get people's names and addresses, because there'll be hundreds and thousands of people ringing in very worried to the Casualty Bureau if they felt that their loved ones were near or around the station at that time. So getting names of people who are okay and who are safe does save an awful lot of police time when relatives ring up and are trying to trace missing people. And people often are a great shock as well, so they will wander away from the scene and, you know, obviously to try and get away as fast as possible. So I think, you know, he just reacted as a police officer would do, and you know, his quick thinking probably reassured a huge number of relatives who were calling in.
It just is a really stunning image, you know, this police officer shouting it at this streaming mass to please stop, give me your details, and they are doing that. It just really is quite an image. But it also brings us to another question. How much are the police, the beat cops, the subway cops, if you will, a part of this investigation and treating this more like a crime scene, like a crime, than, let's say, a war on terror?
Yeah, so I think that's been the police message very much from the start, and all the press conferences that were given over the unfolding of the day and over the weekend were very much that, you know, these are criminals and this is a criminal investigation, and the police officers who were at the scene would have treated it like a crime scene. There were forensic experts going in, scenes of crimes officers going in, and, you know, this is something that the Metropolitan Police, Counterterrorism Unit, City of London Police and British Transport Police have been working over for years, really, because of all the IRA terrorism on the mainland, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and they would have worked very closely together, and you know, this was very much a criminal investigation to try and find out who perpetrated these terrible crimes.
Well, Katrina, we know that Britain has other forces, the equivalent of the FBI and the CIA here in the U.S. How much are the police on the beat a part of the further investigation?
Yes, well, I think a lot of the comments have come out and said that policemen on the beat are very important because they're the eyes and the ears of the community. If they can spot if someone's going to be going away for a few weeks or if there's any changes in behaviour in local communities, I mean, they're very important to feed that up through the sort of chain of intelligence. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner last week, Sir Ian Blair, said that in relation to the Olympics, that that was one of the key things, was the close cooperation between the police and the security services. So they do work very closely together. Some of the people who've been found in the wreckage and are thought to be the bombers, who had been arrested for minor offences, so like public order and shoplifting, I think, was the other one.
So two had some sort of police record.
Yeah, sort of, but not connected to terrorism.
Of course, of course.
Organizations, yeah.
Of course. How much were the police involved in scanning the security tapes that were in the train stations and, you know, picking up the evidence at the scene that actually led to those four suspects?
Oh, well, they would have been in control of the operation. I mean, the CCTV cameras would have been very closely monitored by the police. The police would have been in control of that operation.
We understand that British police have long worked closely with the Muslim community in particular. What happens now?
In our magazine this week, the chief officer's lead on counterterrorism and community relations has said that officers should treat retaliatory hate crimes as really part of the terrorist incident. He's described how a Muslim officer has been travelling on a train since the bombings, with someone wearing a hijab, and had been stared at by other passengers. And, you know, this isn't an experience this is an experience that is not uncommon to other Muslims. And, you know, there's a warning to police officers not to overreact, and really try and reassure, Muslim communities who will be quite afraid to go out, that the police will be protecting them, and that the community should not feel isolated.
How are police viewed by the Muslim community? Are police, for instance, in Britain allowed to profile?
Sorry, what do you mean by profile?
Oh, is that not a phrase that you use in Britain? But here in this country, it means to view someone by their ethnic or racial background. So, for instance,
oh, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the police, have worked hard to build up community relations, but obviously there is sort of fear and suspicion on both sides. But I think the message that's come out very clearly last week and this week as well is that, you know, the police officers, are there to protect. And this is where the community beat officers, the bobbies on the beat, will be sort of working nonstop, really, to talk to nearby residents and neighbours. And, they're just as worried about, what might have been going on in their community as anyone else it would be.
You mentioned the policeman in the hijab riding on the tube. Are there many Muslim police?
Yes, there are. There's a Muslim police association. I'm not exactly sure of the figures, but the Metropolitan Police and a lot of the bigger Metropolitan forces have been trying to reflect within recruiting with ethnic minority officers as much, to reflect the communities that they police. So, yeah, there's been a big drive in that in the last few years, which has, helped change attitudes as well in different forces.
Katrina Marchant is editor of Jane's Police Review. It's thread by sergeants, constables, police rank and file. Katrina, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And next, we'll speak to one of those British cops on the street. Stay with us. There's much more coming up here and now. Editor of the British Policeman's Trade Journal, Jane's Police Review, about how police forces in London responded a week ago and how they've conducted their investigation since then. Well, one of the policemen who happened to be at the scene of the bombings was Detective Sergeant George Roden of the London Metropolitan Police Department. He's also chair of the Black Police Association for his force. He's assigned to a specialist intelligence unit and currently on assignment. Detective Sergeant, welcome.
Hello.
Well, first of all, it's been a week since we know Londoners stood silent in Memorial today. How is the force getting on a week after this bombing?
Okay, well, since the bombing itself, we're trying to get on with business as usual. However, we understand that there are going to be hard times ahead.
Yeah. We understand that a lot of the officers who responded to the attacks had just come out of training. And that some of the officers have had to had, you know, counseling afterwards, which would be understandable.
Yes, from what I saw down there firsthand, I saw the initial officers that were there, and myself being with 25 years service, I was particularly worried about how they were going to cope after the effects, but that didn't come until much, much later. But what I did see is the professionalism, the bravery, and heroism that that these officers shown. People have been speaking about myself, but I was only there by matter of chance, by my train being diverted into King's Cross as I'm on my way to work at Scotland Yard. And these initial officers were actually the ones that actually went down into the tunnel to evacuate and also recover some of the individuals who were very seriously injured, and I dealt with them as they came out.
And these were pretty traumatized victims and officers, we understand. And you, as you said, were there by happenstance, put on your badge, and as we just noted, took out a paper and pencil and started asking people what?
Well, my initial reaction was obviously quite shocked by the injuries that I'd seen, and then I saw the officers themselves were inundated with people, so I put my badge on display and demonstrate who I was, and it was like being the Pied Piper. Then there were these people there in front of myself needing assistance, whether it be first aid or reassurance, and so I immediately got out of my folder with pen and paper and started to take the details. And the reason why for this is that I did not want to lose the possible evidence that would have been there, you know, the witnesses' statements and things like that. We knew something was coming, but we didn't know when. And maybe we should have known when, and we should have known who was involved. So we'll learn about that once a review of the whole process takes place.
Yeah, you say you knew something was coming. What do you mean by that?
Well, from the 9/11, we knew that since Iraq, we are targets. So when I say we knew, you know, we had in our minds that there was going to be attack on our mainland. Didn't know actually know when, but we were accepting the fact that we were a main target. So that's where I'm coming from what I've just said.
Well, I know that since that day, a week ago, you've been involved in investigating the crime, as many police have been. We know that closed-circuit cameras and a phone call from a mother of one of the suspects were key in blowing open the case. And it's police who had to wade through all of that material. But I'm wondering, what's your sense of this investigation? Is good old-fashioned police footwork as important, you know, as high intelligence?
Yes, it is. You know, people's perceptions and people's intelligence, and I would say as well, with the technical abilities that we have now, it was far beyond what we've ever had in the past. And with our international links as well, it's assisted us in building up pictures of certain individuals and certain groups that are wanting to cause harm to our different communities. But when it comes to good old-fashioned coppering, as it may be put, you know,
What was that word you used? What is it?
Good old-fashioned coppering, meaning good old-fashioned policing, where we have detectives and other police staff involved in detailed investigations.
And as I said, we're speaking to Detective Sergeant George Roden of the London Metropolitan Police Department, but he's also chair of the Black Police Association for that force. And, you know, I'm wondering, Sergeant, I imagine that an organization like the Black Police Association is keenly aware of the role that community relations can play in protecting a community, but also, you know, some of the things that can go wrong. How is your association approaching this investigation?
This bomb, this incident, was indiscriminate. And whilst it's been indiscriminate, we have to fight it as one and not to isolate communities. Our intelligence gathering has to be from the community. The Black Police Association has been doing this for many years. We invest our time into our young people by having several programs within the communities.
And Sergeant, I'm wondering, you know, again, you cannot, on so many levels, you can't compare 9/11 and 7/7 as it's become known in Britain. And one of the levels is scope. I mean, the scope of 9/11 was so comparatively huge. But I'm wondering, you know, post 9/11, there were American soldiers at in airports and at many public places, and it seems that in London, it's the police who have become more visible.
We do have the expertise. And it's a different remit, really, in both sets of countries, different rules. And what we do here is that we ensure that the police have the expertise in doing this. We try and keep the military out of this for as long as we possibly can. The military have a different scope to the investigations. They do assist us. However, we do that in a specialist capacity. And you will not see them on a visible aspect unless it's very, very, very serious. However, you will not see them policing the streets because we do have the expertise, we do have the knowledge, we do have the tactical awareness, because our main priority as well is keeping community cohesion as well as tackling any levels of threat that we have.
Detective Sergeant George Roden is with the London Metropolitan Police Department. He's speaking to us from assignment in Britain. Sergeant, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have this note. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Move Over Willy Wonka? We'll review Johnny Depp's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Today, in a Shiite neighborhood in East Baghdad, mourners fired guns and gathered for a funeral procession for some of those killed when a suicide bomber drove his SUV into a crowd and detonated it. More than 25 died in yesterday's attack, including a U.S. soldier and 18 children and teenagers who had swarmed around a U.S. Humvee to get the candy and toys the U.S. troops were handing out. Suicide bombers also struck near the Green Zone in central Baghdad today. Two Iraqi policemen were killed in that attack. Figures from the Iraqi government show that civilians are bearing the brunt of the violence there. During the first 6 months of this year, nearly 1,600 civilians have died in violence. Nearly 900 Iraqi security forces were killed in bombings, assassinations, or clashes with insurgents in the same period. Well, when U.S. soldiers return from serving in Iraq, they can face a range of problems, such as how to find a job. A group of Army National Guardsmen currently stationed near Baghdad is getting a head start. Once a week, at the end of their shift, they huddle over a laptop in a makeshift tent for a class on how to start your own business. It's believed to be the first such effort in the nation, and it was established by the soldier's long-distance teacher in Billerica, Massachusetts. Here Now's Audie Cornish has more on the story.
Louis Celli is wearing shorts and sneakers rather than his usual pajama bottoms. Today, he's all business.
I want them to feel like there's actually an instructor standing in front of them. And even though they don't see me from the waist down, they see me from the waist up, and it's a visual impression that they get.
He's in a crisp white shirt, red and black striped tie. Not a chestnut-colored hair is out of place. He's ready for class to begin.
Let's look at location, location, location. If anybody's ever been in real estate, they'll say that they're really
culture.
Who is that one target market, and what are you saying to them? What is the perfect business? We remember the perfect business having no liability,
go to overhead,
your workbooks.
Over the next 2 hours, Celli's Billerica home is headquarters for a business seminar for entrepreneurs. The room is packed with computer equipment, a laptop on the twin-size bed, a flat-panel monitor on his desk, four different printers, and two modems.
Can you hear me? Hello?
At least four different windows are open on his computer screen. The most important is a chat window with the image of a ghostly male silhouette that represents his students stationed near Baghdad.
Why do you keep hanging up on me?
That's the voice of Sergeant First Class Richard Gazovsky over a satellite-based internet connection. Gazovsky and some 40 other members of the Massachusetts Army National Guard take the course at the end of their 12-hour shift. The students, all men, are using just one laptop and an improvised projector screen made from mess hall butcher paper to follow the seminar. And just like that, okay, the soldiers are connecting with Chelly live from Iraq.
We're back. All right. So they can hear me. We're going to go ahead and continue. I'm going to give you guys a project to work on.
Although the connection can be iffy, Chelly uses online meeting software and an internet-based radio station, which he bought just for this. Soldiers type their questions and answers through a chat window or, on days when the connection is good, speak to Chelly live online. Over the course of 9 weeks, they will create both a business and feasibility plan. And the students are looking at everything from auto repair shops and contracting businesses to a daycare center. The toughest part isn't the reading or the sometimes poor internet connection. From Iraq, Sergeant Gazovsky tells us that it's the market research.
We've only got access to the internet. We don't have access to customers that we can go and do questionnaires with or surveys. We don't have libraries we can go to do research. So there's a lot more we could do back home than we can do here. But Lewis has showed us how we can get it done and get something workable done while we're over here.
This is a positive environment for them. It gets them to stop thinking about, will I make it back, and gets them to think about when I make it back.
Their teacher, Lewis Chelly, is a former Army Sergeant recruiter and founder of the Northeast Veterans Business Resource Center. After retiring from the armed services a few years ago, he entered the job market with more than 20 years of high-level sales experience, but no college degree.
I was disappointed to learn that my skills were not considered to be as valuable as other sales managers who had been doing the job just as long or even not as long.
Even though he's proud of his Army career, Chelly says he feels he's losing out to civilian colleagues who over the years have been networking and resume building in the private sector.
If 50 years ago you retired from the military and you went to, really to any large corporation and you were understood to be a superior leader and you were hired based on those merits, that is completely not the case in today's economy. It's more about, well, you've been away from the business world for 22 years. What do you have to show me?
Chelly's story echoes in the labor statistics for young veterans today. The unemployment rate for veterans in their early 20s has risen from 9% in 2001 to almost 14% last year. And although veterans overall have a lower unemployment rate than the general population, young male vets suffer from an unemployment rate that's double that of all other veterans. Chelly sent out a blanket email to the Bay State's National Guard looking for returned veterans. But when some 40 deployed soldiers made a special request to take the class from overseas, he couldn't say no. He got a grant from the nonprofit Veterans Corporation, plus donations from software companies to make it happen.
Having been deployed, I know what it's like to feel like you're missing out as the world passes you by. I know what it's like to feel that. And I didn't want this to be just one more thing that was passing them by as they were deployed. I wanted to be able to bring it to them so that they could participate.
Back in Iraq, Gazovsky speaks for the class on a very patchy connection. He says they all appreciate the help.
It gives us some hope that we are going home and that we're kind of making plans for the future. We're not just concentrating on what we're doing here.
Right now, Gazovsky and the rest of Chelly's class are more than halfway through the 9-week seminar. They'll leave the course with a business plan, a free website, and 500 business cards. And hopefully, Chelly says, the tools to pursue their dreams.
That story from Here and Now's Audie Cornish. For a look at how the seminar for soldiers is set up and for links to information about the program, go to our website, here-now.org. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. And still to come, what makes crossword puzzle geeks tick? And are people who do the puzzles nicer than the rest of us? You're listening to Here and Now. The National Hockey League and its union have reached a tentative deal on a new contract. This comes after the NHL became the first U.S. pro sports league to lose an entire season to a lockout. The owners and players are expected to ratify the new deal next week. Only a game's Bill Littlefield spoke with Scott Burnside of ESPN, who says in the contract negotiations, the players appear to be shut out by the owners.
The owners won every significant point. They have essentially embarrassed the union. They have destroyed the membership's confidence in leadership, specifically Executive Director Bob Goodenow. And Commissioner Gary Bettman, who was earlier listed as one of the worst managers in North America, has delivered to his ownership constituency everything he promised. So the players have taken a knee and more on this one.
Let's talk about some of the particulars. The union conceded a 24% salary rollback, the salary cap they swore at one point that they would never accept, a tie-in to league revenue, a nullification of all 2004-2005 contracts. The list goes on and on. When was the last time a union representing pro athletes conceded so much?
Well, I don't think it's ever happened. And just in the same way that no pro sports league has ever allowed an entire season to go by the boards because of a labor dispute. So we are in uncharted territories here when you talk about what the league and its players have done to themselves and to the sport in general. I will say, though, that there is something about this agreement that there are some elements that should be player-friendly. They won't be evident today, but coming in the next 4 or 5 years, players will be able to be unrestricted free agents at a much younger age, which in theory will allow them to, you know, test the limits of the market within the salary cap, of course. And if you are optimistic about the health of this league, the fact that the players have tied their salaries to league revenues does open the door for a healthy league to grow and the players to grow along with it. Will they ever see average salaries of $1.8 million like they did at the end of the last season? No, but there is possibility for them to grow with the sport.
Can we expect that Bob Goodenow will soon be looking for another job?
That's sort of the knee-jerk insinuation, is that his time with the PA is past. But he is also the man who led them to unprecedented salary heights during the last decade. So I think a little historical perspective may make things a little bit easier for Bob on the way out. He's also under contract, and we talk about players being bought out under this new agreement. Bob Goodenow can expect a very healthy parachute if, in fact, he's pushed out of the NHLPA leadership seat.
You mentioned that Gary Bettman had been characterized as the worst manager in the hemisphere, and now he maybe is very popular among owners. Does he get to be commissioner for life?
I mean, I'm not sure he can be commissioner for life. I think what he has done is created an environment in which it is possible to imagine that 30 NHL teams can survive and, if not thrive, at least not worry about going to bankruptcy court every 4 or 5 months. I think the question now is the NHL really a 30-team league? Is it more than the regional sport that many people believe it is? Bettman has provided a system which will put that to the test. And I think until he's proven wrong, until teams start to fail, even though there's this system in place, I think he'll remain commissioner.
Scott, as I understand the implications of the new agreement, there will soon be a free agent frenzy, the likes of which the National Hockey League has never seen. Will that be a good thing for the league?
I think it will be. I think for all the people in North America who are involved in rotisserie baseball and basketball and hockey leagues, we are talking the ultimate in rotisserie hockey. There are probably between 400 and 450 free agents, either restricted or unrestricted, that will have to be signed between the end of next week after ratification and training camp early in September. So, yes, it will be a frenzy. Teams under the cap will have to dispose of veteran players that are familiar to fans in places like Toronto and Philadelphia, and they may end up in strange places like Nashville and Atlanta and Columbus. So I think it's good. I think it should help and sort of give the impression that this league is, in fact, starting from a fresh slate. And I think that's crucial to the public perception of the National Hockey League.
Only a Games Bill Littlefield spoke with ESPN's Scott Burnside. He's covered the NHL lockout for the past 10 months. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. People do it once a week, some in under 10 minutes. Some, sadly, get frustrated and give up. I'm referring, of course, to crossword puzzles. This addiction is the subject of a new book, Crossworld, One Man's Journey into America's Crossword Obsession. It's by freelance journalist Mark Romano, or as he's known in puzzle circles, a 4 to 10 minute daily puzzler who takes a mere 16 minutes to do the Sunday New York Times Challenge. And Mark joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. It's great to be here.
And I'm trying to somehow telegraph the feel of this book. To me, it's sort of as if Jack Black, who was that rock and roll record store geek from High Fidelity, if he was into crossword puzzles instead of rock and roll. That's sort of how it feels to me.
Yeah. For me, it's more like if Imogene Coca was into crossword puzzles.
You are one of the characters. It's your obsession that we hear a bit about. But also, there are others. Brendan Emmett Quigley, a player from Boston.
A fabulous constructor. In fact, a constructor of genius, in my opinion.
Constructor, one who builds the crossword puzzles. A would-be independent musician, so you see my analogy. It works there. And there's a boozy exchange between the two of you in which you try to sort of get at what it is about crossword puzzles. He says something back to you. Could you just tell us briefly what that exchange is?
Yeah, and I just might lay out exactly why I sort of put a little bit more weight on crossword puzzles, the theory thereof, than some people would find warranted. The reason for this is the first time I went to the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament, which is hosted annually by Will Shortz, the New York Times crossword puzzle editor.
Mm-hmm. And NPR.
And NPR puzzler host, exactly. I walked into the tournament and I was struck by two things. One is the sheer exuberant energy of the 500 or so contestants. And two was the fact that so many of them were so incredibly nice. At the time, I was sort of in the middle of this low-grade depression. I found that I'd sort of lost whatever creative spark that
sure.
I thought I'd possessed. And I decided, well, there's 3,000 puzzles in the electronic archive of the New York Times, so I would do 10 or 15 of them a day as some sort of occupational therapy. And what I discovered was that after about 300, I got better. So I wondered if, in addition to perhaps breeding nice people, crosswords might, under some circumstances, act as a sort of therapy. And those two things taken together made me conceptualize the puzzle as something more than just as a game. Of course, Brendan's laconic reaction to my deep exegesis of the game was to say, Mark, come on, they're just games.
We're talking crossword puzzles here. It's not that complicated.
Exactly. But I respectfully disagree, and so does the book.
Well, so try to tell us, what is the pull of the crossword?
Well, I think many people who are attracted to crossword puzzles are more on the introverted side of the spectrum. So it affords a minor vacation from what is, frankly, an extroverted world for many people. And also there's the sheer pleasure of creating order out of chaos. If a blank grid represents chaos, then a filled one represents completion.
Right. You write late in the book, it's the satisfaction of a job well done. Also, you remember facts and words you spent so much energy wrestling from clues, and when you come back across them in future puzzles, you have this delightful experience of meeting old friends after a long separation.
There's certainly that. I think there's also the tangential benefit that to be a successful crossword puzzler, you really need to know a tremendous amount about the world around you. And it's my assumption that the more real information you have in your head about the real world, chances are the less room there will be in your heart for hatred.
Oh, isn't that a lovely thought?
Thank you.
Well, you are one of the addicts of the sport, if I can, of crossword puzzles. But for those who haven't...
It's a sedentary sport.
Yes, it is. Just take us briefly through some of the intricacies. There are three parts, the grid, the fill, and the cluing. And then there's another term, keying. So could you just give us a definition of each?
Right. Well, the grid is just the square thing with lots of little white boxes. The fill is the words that populate the grid. And the most important part of a crossword puzzle the one that determines the difficulty level of a given puzzle is the cluing, which is this numbered series of clues that, if correctly interpreted, yield the fill. Keying is specific to American puzzles. It's the degree of connectedness of any given letter in the puzzle. In American crossword puzzles, there can be no unkeyed or single-keyed letter. So every letter has to connect to at least
two others,
which guarantees a sort of complex stacking, which is part of the magic of the puzzle.
Give us one of your favorite clues and fills.
Oh, I think it was a sudden upset, and the answer was Super Bowl XVIII. So it was the 36, right? XXXVIII. I'm innumerate in Latin. What makes that absolutely such a great clue, or actually fill, is that when you're doing the puzzle, you see LXXXVI, and that's 86. So you're thrown off track. You don't understand what 86 could have to do with any sport until you realize that the last L in Super Bowl is actually just an L. So there's an aha moment when you finally get all the acrosses.
Well, in your book, which again is called Cross World, you take us to tournaments. After one, in fact, you end up in an emergency room because you've forgotten to eat for 2 days. You're so excited about the whole thing. And you come at the end of the book to sort of an epiphany that has to do with what might have been the earliest crossword puzzle and what the meaning of crosswords are. Can you first of all tell us, what is the Phaistos disk?
It's a very enigmatic little medallion that was found in Crete in, I believe, 1909. It has a specific number of dies. It's made out of clay, so these things imprinted into the clay. So they're obviously preformed. They are probably the first extant type of typeface. Mm-hmm. And they're arranged in the spiral pattern going toward the center of this thing. Nobody has a real idea of what these things are or what they mean. To me, it looks a lot like a spiral word puzzle. So out of the 300 or so theories that you'll see floating if you Google Phaistos disk, let us just add that it might be a crossword puzzle.
Well, and the one that is given credit for being the first one first appeared in a New York newspaper in 1913. It was constructed by editor Arthur Wynn. It was called a word cross originally, but I love reading that somebody just did a typo and so it ended up being crossword.
Sometimes typos are salubrious.
But so you come to a conclusion at the end of your book having to do with the Phaistos disk and Arthur Wynn. Would you please read for us on page 225 there?
Sure. You have to remember that this thought came to me when I was on a gurney and practically unconscious in a hospital.
So. After going to a tournament.
3,000 years after the Phaistos disk was created, knowing the moment was propitious, the gods caused the disk to be uncovered. 5 years after it was found, they breathed its secret into the ear of Arthur Wynn. "Take this wonder of the word cross and heal yourself," they said. And you should probably copyright it, by the way. So nearly a century after the crossword was born or breathed into the fertile mind of Arthur Wynn, you may find yourself in an airport or on a train or in the subway, watching the man or woman beside you assiduously fill in a puzzle. Whatever you do, don't disturb that person. He or she is solving a mystery and at the same time putting back together, word by word, the pieces of our broken world.
That's Mark Romano reading from his new book. It's called Cross World, One Man's Journey into America's Crossword Obsession. Mark, are you pencil or pen?
In civilian life, I'm pen. In tournament, like everybody else, I'm pencil.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Kate Goldring, Joanna Broder, and Noah Suskind. Special thanks today to Dave Shaw, Glenn Alexander, and Jim Bob. Our senior producer is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
But these things your hearts can rise above. Once in a while he won't call.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.